Pneumachia, the Logos of Tron as an Idea. Author, Alexander Dugin. Translator, J. Farnold. Introduction to Pneumachia, the Logos of Tron, the Indo-European Ideology of the Vertical, Moscow, Academic Project, 2017. Tron and Eurasia, Similarities and Differences Between Concepts. The space of northeastern Eurasia upon which Russia has established itself as a state and civilization over the past 500 years represents a special existential horizon. We can call this the Eurasian horizon and speak of a specific Eurasian Dacen. This territory acquired the name Turan in Iranian sacred geography, and this name can by all means be seen as an analogue to the notion of Eurasia. Insofar as we will examine Russian civilization and its logos in a separate volume, and given that in Russian civilization the Eurasian element is largely predominant, it is natural to apply the notion of Eurasia to the study of the Russian logos, as did the Eurasianist philosophers, such as N. S. Trubetskoy, P. N. Savitsky, G. V. Vernadsky, N. N. Alkseev, L. N. Gumilev, etc. In this case, the civilizations of Eurasia, united by a common horizon preceding the emergence of Russia as an historico-cultural axis, can be integrated into the concept of Turan. In Pneumachia, by Turan we mean the civilizations and cultures which took shape on the territory of northeastern Eurasia, with the exception of Russian civilization which is examined in a separate study. This, of course, is a rather conditional division, as Russian civilization itself can be studied from different angles of view, whether as part of the Slavic world, as a most important component of the Byzantine Orthodox space, as something self-sufficient and unique, samobitno, in the likes of continent Russia, or as one historical expression of the existential horizon of Turan. In the present volume of Pneumachia, we will focus on those peoples who took shape on the territory of Turan before and or parallel to the Russians. In this case, establishing a correspondence between the logos of Turan and the Russian logos might be the next important step, allowing for a better understanding of both. Yet another important consideration to be taken into account is that, originally, we planned for this volume of Pneumachia to examine all the civilizations either belonging to the Eurasian group or figuring under Eurasian influence. Thus, as we have just said, for us Turan and Eurasia were to function as synonyms. However, over the course of working on this subject, we have found that such might be divided into two components. Firstly, we can speak of the Indo-European, and only Indo-European, nomadic cultures that formed on the territory of Eurasia, more precisely in the space of the Great Steppe, in the period from the 5th millennium BC to the 1st millennium AD. Secondly, we can consider those non-Indo-European peoples, on whom the influence of the nomadic Indo-European societies of the Great Steppe was decisive and fundamental, and who subsequently inherited the Indo-Europeans' mission starting in the 1st centuries AD, with the invasion of the Huns, and continuing up to the 19th century. Thus, we have divided our study into two volumes. In the first, present book, The Logos of Turan, we focus exclusively on the Indo-European peoples who arose in the Great Steppe and spread their influence across virtually the whole territory of the Eurasian continent. In the second volume, The Horizons and Civilizations of Eurasia, the Indo-European Legacy and the Traces of the Great Mother, we follow the transfer of this steppic, nomadic, martial tradition to other, non-Indo-European peoples, first and foremost of the Altaic family, and we study the influence of Indo-European culture on other neighboring civilizations, such as the Siberian, and Paleo-Asiatic, the Tibetan, the Finno-Ugric, and the Caucasian. For the sake of clarity of exposition, we have thus had to divide our preliminary conceptualization of the shared identity of the notions of Turan and Eurasia into two postulates. We understand Turan to be the civilization created in the space of the Great Eurasian Steppe by the Indo-European peoples and then transmitted directly to other nomadic peoples, first and foremost the Altaic. By Eurasia, we mean the much wider spectrum of existential horizons, including Turan, as the core of the Eurasian continent, both Indo-European as well as post-Indo-European, Turco-Mongolian, and the totality of civilizations and cultures that formed around the periphery of the Great Steppe, which were influenced, both directly and indirectly, by Turan and the Indo-Europeans. Thus, Turan should be considered the core, center, and heart of Eurasia, and Eurasia itself as the broader geosophical context including both Turanian and non-Turanian elements, both Indo-European and non-Indo-European cultures. This situation is further complicated by the fact that, moving throughout the space of Eurasia, some Indo-European cultures lost their primordial, axial identity. For example, the ancient Lydians and Phrygians in Anatolia, or the peoples of Western Europe in modernity, while at the same time some non-Indo-European peoples, above all the Altaic peoples, as well as the Tibetans, the Uralic peoples, the peoples of the Caucasus, and even some Paleo-Asiatics, such as the Kets, adopted and laid such at the foundation of their cultures. It is precisely with regards to this dialectic that the title of the second volume of Pneumachia dedicated to the question of Turan and Eurasia features an appeal to the gestalt of the Great Mother. If the logos of Turan is at the center of the Eurasian continent and represents pure Apollonianism, then on their, new logically, opposite pole is the logos of Cybele. In the projection of this new logical structure onto the geographical map, we can see that the logos of Cybele exerts decisive influence around the periphery of the Eurasian continent, that is, it is built into the geosophical structure of Eurasia. If the logos of Apollo dominates in Turan, the Great Steppe, then in the periphery traces of another civilization can be noted, one in which Chthonic motives, Titanism, and matriarchy predominate. Turan, Apollonianism, exerted its influence, embodied first and foremost and most lucidly of all in the Indo-European nomadic, warrior cultures, on all the peoples and cultures of Eurasia, but its strength diminished insofar as it neared the coastal zones of the Eurasian continent where, on the contrary, the logos of Cybele has been proportionally strong. This constitutes the main geosophical map of Eurasia and the dialectical essence of the Eurasian horizons. But in order to be convinced of this thesis, we need to study and dissect first the structures of the Indo-European civilizations and cultures of Turan, in order to determine their new logical nature, and then, with the achieved results, turn to surveying other peoples and societies. The conceptual difference between Turan and Eurasia will be fully clear upon acquaintance with these two volumes of Pneumachia, which represent a whole, or two parts of one and the same study. As follows, it bears recalling that the methodological foundation of Pneumachia was expounded in the first two volumes, the Three Logoi, Apollo, Dionysus, and Cybele and Geosophy, Horizons and Civilizations, and the examination of individual societies and cultures belonging to the circle of the Indo-European horizon has already been undertaken in the individual Pneumachia volumes dedicated to the study of the Germanic, French, Latin, and Greek logoi, to the civilization of Great Britain, the Semitic world, and the Indian and Iranian cultures. All of the latter volumes of Greater Pneumachia are of principal importance to adequately understanding the logos of Turan, just as, in turn, this volume and its closely adjoined companion, Horizons and Civilizations of Eurasia, can be considered key to the above cited. Taken together, all of these works constitute a most important cornerstone of the geosophy of Eurasia. The Turanian Proto-Culture Ala Oswald Spengler. As the special space of a self-sufficient civilization, Turan has only rarely been the subject of what have been rather narrowly specialized and thematic studies. One exception to this is the work of Oswald Spengler, 1880-1936, who discerned Turan to be a particular civilizational field of principal significance to mankind as a whole. Spengler developed his theory of Turan in his unfinished work under the working title The Epic of Man, fragments of which have been published and made accessible to scholars only recently. In this work, Spengler describes the voluminous field of history as consisting of four main stages or phases, A, B, C, and D. phase lasted from the undetermined time of the first signs of Homo sapiens to the Upper Paleolithic. Spengler generally adheres to the concept of evolution, but he imparts such with a particular cyclical dimension. For our part, we categorically reject this theory and appeal to such exclusively from the standpoint of describing cultures while discarding any genetic continuity, much less hierarchy between societies built on notions of more ancient versus more modern, where more modern is seen as more developed, perfect, and differentiated than ancient. The first signs of reasoning men might appear in one or another epoch only to disappear in another. Everything depends on how we understand reason, a question which is in itself conditioned by a specific culture and mythology. Therefore, no universal criteria can be accepted here, and all the more insufficient are any attempts at building a progressive sequence from less rational types of society and man towards more rational. If we engage in such, we are simply projecting the criteria of our own society, for example, modern Western or Western-centric, onto all types of society in general, which is in itself illegitimate and incorrect ethnocentrism. Therefore, for Spengler, phaser is purely a conditionality meant to inform us that we know nothing for sure of this epoch and can advance no hypotheses on this matter. Phase B, according to Spengler, is situated in the interim from 20,000 to 6,000 BC and is characterized by man's discovery of the inner world, the soul, and the phenomenon of death. Spengler metaphorically likens this period to his beloved crystals and minerals. Phase B, according to Spengler, means the presence of self-consciousness, distinguishable by the modern scholar, and identifiable in the traces of ancient cultures. Although Spengler and many of our contemporaries in general conceive of such self-consciousness as simpler, this does not mean that it really was such. Spengler calls both phase A and phase B non-organic, and the two following, C and D, organic. Spengler compares the third phase, C, to the slowly but autonomously moving simplest animal, the amoeba. In this phase, proto-cultures are formed which will later, in phase D lasting up to the present day, lie at the heart of all the historically known historico-cultural types. Spengler enumerates three proto-cultures, three civilizational amoebas at stage C, 1, the Atlantic, 2, the Cushite, and 3, the Turanian. The Atlantic culture, in Spengler's view, claimed the western parts of Europe and Africa, and was distinguished by a heightened concern with the post-mortem worlds. In classical archaeology, the pre-Indo-European population of Europe, to which belonged the Minoans, the Pelasgians, the Basques, the Sicels, the Iberians, and the Lelages, to which some would also add the Picts, and so on, is generally considered to be the bearer of this Atlantic culture. This is the culture of the other world. Hence the immense monuments erected for the deceased, the cult of the other world and its divinities, and the cyclopean constructions typical of this culture, such as the megaliths. This culture was preoccupied with questions of genetic identity, blood, which connects the living to the world of the dead. Hence the beginning of mummification, embalmment, and luxuriant burial rituals. The Atlantic culture was the culture of living death. The second proto-culture of Epoch C was the Cushite culture, whose center Spengler situates in the south of Eurasia between India and the Red Sea. This proto-culture was typified by a preoccupation with the idea of fate, as if such were a mathematical law of the world embodied in the sky to which all processes on earth are subject. The Cushite culture was indifferent towards death and life, instead concentrating all of its attention on the study of the mathematical patterns of the world. In phase D, the Cushite style would be most fully of all expressed in Assyrio-Babylonian civilization. The third type of proto-culture is that of Turan, and it is here that we arrive at ideas which resonate with both Numakia and some of the philosophical and historical intuitions of the Russian Eurasianist thinkers. The proto-culture of Turan, according to Spengler, represents a pure heroic style. At its center stands the battle of the hero against the forces of death and fate. the hero and his I are put in the forefront and recognized to be a divine element. The world is full of the forces of life and is the field of endless battle. Neither fate, of the Kushite style, nor death, in the Atlantic style, are higher values for the man of Turin. Immortality is achieved only through battle, and a dignified life was believed to be one lived with a high raised head. The gods of the martial civilizations of Turin embody this archetype. They are warriors, fearless, and indomitable. Spengler considers the chariot to be the most important symbol of the Turanian style. The identification of the chariot with the Indo-Europeans is not only Spengler's hypothesis, but is the common ground of archaeology. Indeed, the most ancient traces of chariots are to be found in Eurasia, in the South Urals around 2000 BC, and the first whole chariots were found in the Sintashta cultural circle dated to the end of the 21st century BC. Around 2700 BC, the first traces of carts, which preceded the first war chariots, the Maikop culture, are also to be found in Turin. It is from the South Urals that chariots began to disperse throughout the surrounding regions, including all the way up to the Caspian and Aral Sea, and across Eurasia in both directions, to Western Europe, all the way up to the Atlantic, and to the Far East. Around 1200 BC, waves of warlike peoples on chariots descended towards the Mediterranean and founded new types of cultures. The Achaeans flooded Greece and settled in Mycenae. The Hyksos invaded Egypt, and the Kassites seized Babylon. In the very same period, Indo-European warriors on chariots advanced into Hindustan and built the Vedic culture of India on top of the remains of the ancient Mohenjo-daro and Harappan cultures, which, in Spengler's view, belonged to the Kushite type. In China, the bearers of the Zhou civilization also arrived on chariots and conquered China. Thus, almost simultaneously, the bearers of the Turanian element, the civilization of Nmeba C, founded the three high cultures of Phase D, the Chinese, the Indian, and the Hellenic, in parallel with the Turanian invasions of the Babylonian and Egyptian civilizational zones. Thus, according to Spengler, the Indo-European peoples of Turin and their heroic style exerted decisive influence on the birth of the majority of the classical civilizations of the Old World, in whose shadow we continue to live to this day. Lev Gumilev, and the study of Eurasia and the nomadic empires of Turin. The study of the nomadic civilizations of Eurasia, less known to European scholarship, constituted the core of the historical works of the Russian historian Lev Gumilev, 1912-1992. Developing the particular approach of the Eurasianist philosophers, Gumilev devoted increased attention to the nomadic empires and ethnoi of Turin, demonstrating their fundamental influence on both the formation of Russian statehood and the histories of other civilizations. In his works on the Huns, the ancient Turks, the Mongols, the Sarmatians, and other ancient nomadic peoples, Gumilev showed that the latter were not barbarian tribes, but rather the bearers of a special cultural code associated with a particular value system, worldview, and ethics peculiar to the inhabitants of the steppes and the warrior nomads of Eurasia. This ethical model was established in the Great Yaza Code of Genghis Khan and was addressed towards a particular type of people, the people of long will. According to Gumilev, Eurocentric perspectives hinder full appreciation of the dignity of the civilization of Turin. For the historical Europeans, such was seen as the territory of barbarians, from which the danger of attacks and invasions emanated from time to time. Perceiving the space of northeastern Eurasia in such a manner, Europe thus considered this land to be the periphery of civilization, where one could find only scattered and incoherent relics taken from more developed cultures of the Mediterranean or India. But Gumilev demonstrated that if we look at the surrounding peoples and civilizations from the standpoint of Turanian man, through his own eyes, then we are revealed an entirely different picture, one saturated with nuances and hints, with a fully fledged and complex historial, and with a special identity and numerous overlapping cultural circles in need of attentive and scrupulous study. The civilizations of Turin were predominantly nomadic, and this is their distinctive trait. In the eyes of the sedentary civilizations, the culture of the nomadic peoples was constantly perceived to be hostile and alien. Moreover, nomadic conditions were not conducive to the development of literary and architectural objects, which necessarily poses difficulty to any study of this culture's content. Gumilev nevertheless called for overcoming both Eurocentrism and the clichés of the settled civilizations, and urged us to attempt to reconstruct, on the basis of the data we have in myths, chronicles, legends, travelers' accounts, etc., the structure of Turanian identity as it remained unchanged at its core, independent of the numerous peoples who subsequently or simultaneously became its bearers. Leo Frobenius, Telluric Culture and the Feminine Sun. The theories of the German historian and anthropologist Leo Frobenius, 1873-1938, might also be of use for identifying the typology of the civilization of Turan. Frobenius associates every culture, in his terminology, paedeuma, with earth, land and the organization of landscape. Relations with and approaches to land therefore determine the essence of a given human culture. Thus, Frobenius proposed the following formula. Culture is earth that has become organic by means of man. On these grounds, Frobenius constructed a dual topography of culture using the metaphor of plants. According to Frobenius, the paedeuma can be seen as a plant, having roots and a stem with branches and leaves. Such is the composition of the two halves of one organism, one part moves into and under the earth, which Frobenius called the chthonic element, while the other draws upwards from the earth, this is the telluric element. Both are tied to earth, to land, but in different ways. The chthonic is drawn to that from which it came, while the telluric strives towards the other, away from the soil from which it emerged. Both trajectories constitute the life of a culture. Thus, according to Frobenius, cultures, paedeuma, can be divided into two types or poles. One pole, the chthonic, is tied to the matriarchal element and exhibits centripetal tendencies, being drawn towards contraction, being closed or self-absorbed. The second, telluric pole is associated with the patriarchal element, with centrifugal motion, the feeling of expansion, overcoming limits, dynamism, and striving to break away from roots. Turan, in Frobenius' account, is the principal space of telluric culture. While matriarchal cultures are inclined towards creating dwellings in caves, pits, and in dugouts, then patriarchal cultures erect homes and, at times, great homes, which reflect the aspiration to create something large and gigantic. Such great homes served religious aims, initiations, and ceremonies among archaic peoples. Patriarchal societies are also constructed along a vertical geometry. The child reaches upwards from the earth, and society and social institutions are conceived as the branches of a tree, the point of a spear or an arrow, and become symbols of the axis around which hunting, war, and rituals are organized. Patriarchal cultures appreciate that which strives upward, especially fire. Hence the rites of cremating bodies. Death is understood as a prelude to new birth, like the seeding of plants. Matriarchal, chthonic cultures, on the other hand, value above all the material, the corporeal, and the maternal, and all that is associated with the lower levels of the universe, with that which is hidden within earth. Hence the social practices of gathering roots, berries, and mushrooms. Both poles of culture envision space differently, on which point Frobenius emphasizes. The telluric is the peace of unlimited space. The chthonic is the unrest of confined space. In Frobenius' view, it is the polarization of these two types of culture and their subsequent impositions upon one another that established the social architecture of civilizations with which we have to deal up to the present day. The territory of Turan, and more specifically the steppe zones of Eurasia, the Great Steppe, were the primordial hearth of the centrifugal cultures of the telluric, patriarchal, type, while the coasts of the Mediterranean and South Asia represent the zones of centripetal matriarchal cultures. The expansion of mobile, masculine cultures into the territories of the chthonic zones led to the emergence of the great cultures of India, West Asia, the Aegean zone, Rome, France, and England. Moreover, in Frobenius' view, these patriarchal cultures carry strength and vital life forces, while the matriarchal element imparted them with plastic forms. It is in this synthesis, in this dialectic between the telluric and chthonic, that Frobenius sees all of world history. The telluric impulse, according to Frobenius, ceaselessly emanated from the territories of Turin. Also of extreme importance to discerning the civilizations of Turin is Frobenius' study of various symbols, which he proposed to differentiate between types of society. Alongside the chthonic and telluric, Frobenius drew attention to another detail, the gender of the two celestial luminaries, the sun and the moon, across the languages and mythologies of all the world's peoples. Working through an enormous mass of linguistic and mythological material, Frobenius discerned an extremely interesting pattern, according to which all cultures can be distinguished as belonging to one of three basic groups with relation to the following symbols. 1. The masculine sun and feminine moon, envisioned in the form of man and wife or as brother and sister, joined in incestuous, but not explicitly censured marital bond. 2. The feminine sun and masculine moon, Aulonus, envisioned only as brother and sister, whose incestuous relationship is explicitly taboo. The violation of this taboo, generally by the moon, is understood to be a catastrophe and drama. 3. The masculine sun and masculine moon as two brothers. The systematization of such an enormous mass of materials on the basis of all the sources available to him led Frobenius to construct a series of maps designating the zones dominated by each of these three forms. One is immediately struck by the fact that these zones represent stable poles which remain uninterrupted by the borders running between ethnoi, cultures, peoples, and civilizations. Moreover, the commonality of this symbol can even be found among cultures which otherwise lack anything similar and are even to be found on different civilizational levels. The map of the distribution of the masculine sun and feminine moon looks thusly. We can clearly follow an uninterrupted strip running from England in northern Europe through the northern Mediterranean, Anatolia and the Middle East to India, South China, Polynesia, and up to Central America and the northeastern coast of South America. All of the indigenous cultures of these regions exhibit stable attributions of the male gender to the sun. According to Frobenius, cultures of this type are of a matriarchal orientation and cultivate everything associated with space. To a significant extent, sacrality is derived from the number four, as in the four directions, orientations of space. The following map delineates the distribution zone of cultures in which the sun is depicted as female and the moon as of male gender. Here we can see that the territory of Turin is the core of the cultural space of the male moon and female sun. This space is distinguished by its patriarchal orientation, and at the center of its attention are time and symbolic and religious systems in which the number three occupies the central place. Thus, the telluric character of Turin is confirmed in its distribution of the pair of the male moon and female moon, as well as by the predominance of the symbolism of time and the number three. René Guénon, The Culture of Abel and the Civilization of Mantras. Insofar as Turin is principally the zone of nomadic civilizations, the symbolism of nomadic societies is crucial to the study of Turanian identity. The French traditionalist philosopher René Guénon, 1887-1953, drew attention to the symbolic peculiarities between the structures of nomadic societies, nomadism, and settled peoples, sedentarism. According to Guénon, in the biblical context the figure who most generally represents nomads and pastoralists is Abel. Guénon writes, "They, Cain and Abel, are the types of the two sorts of peoples who have existed since the origins of the present humanity, or at least since the earliest differentiation took place, namely that between the sedentary peoples, devoted to the cultivation of the soil, and the nomads, devoted to the raising of flocks and herds. According to Genon, the notions of Iran and Turin also reflect this dualism, even etymologically. In Genon's view, the term area, from which is derived the word Iran or Ariana, the land of the Aryans, originally referred to someone engaged in agriculture, in this case from the Indo-European root ar, hence the Latin arare, to plow, arator, plowman, and arvum, field. The ancient Jews were nomads and shepherds, and therefore their sacred texts unequivocally take the side of Abel as the victim of Cain. Abel is considered to be the righteous, while Cain is the brother killer and cursed. Genon believed that pastoralists and nomads conceptualized the principle of time as unfolding in front of them, as their priority object, their element, all the while as they enjoyed the quality of unending space. Settled peoples, who conversely embody the permanence, or synchronism, of space, have time as their main object. Settled societies live in a fixed place, and therefore time is closed and constant. Living long cycles in the same place, settled cultures begin to attentively observe time, study its structures, and investigate its patterns. They thereby conceive themselves to be the historical and unhistorical phenomenon, that is, something lasting, uniting past and future. Nomadic peoples, for their part, do not create anything solid or long-term. They live in open space, which is their existential element. They unfold their potential in space, while time remains a secondary matter. They do not devote extensive attention to time or the method of its dimension. In Genon's view, settled cultures therefore embody the principle of compression or squeezing, while nomadic ones exhibit stretching and expansion. The fact that nomads are primarily engaged in the herding of cattle symbolically corresponds to their mobility. Cereal and plant cultivation, conversely, are peculiar to settled cultures which, like plants, are immobile and tied to one place. Thus, settled cultures assign priority to the development of visual forms of sacred art, such as paintings, sculptures, architecture, etc. In Hinduism, such sacred images are called yantra. For nomadic peoples, meanwhile, visual depictions are often taboo, whereas the symbolism of sound is considerably more developed, as is the case with the Hindu mantras. In Genon's analysis, vision is related to space, while hearing is tied to time. As follows, settled cultures develop plastic forms of art, while nomadic peoples tend to develop sonorous forms, such as music, poetry, etc. As a concept, Turin is undoubtedly the field of nomadic civilization, the civilization of Abel. This does not exclude the presence in Eurasia of significant enclaves of settled societies, but the dominant identity of Turin is none other than nomadism. Hence the dominating factor of space, the scarcity of visual monuments, the absence of developed writing, and many other traits specific to Turanian culture. Turin, for Genon, is the civilization of mantras. The Turanian factor, the vertical turn. By correlating these introductory considerations, we can obtain a preliminary picture of the object of our study. Turin is the horizon of northeastern Eurasia coinciding with the Great Steppe, stretching from Transylvania in the west to Manchuria in the east. In terms of culture, this horizon is primarily the zone of inhabitants of nomadic peoples. We are dealing with a nomadic civilization dominated by the militaristic and patriarchal element, that is, a culture of the Telluric type. The influence of Turin is associated with expansion, as in accordance with Genon. Indeed, historically, Turanian expansion to the south and west repeatedly led to the establishment of new states, cultures, and developed civilizations, in which the peoples of Turin became the ruling class, the legislators of patriarchal style and, quite frequently, the bearers of the dominant language. The civilizations and polities of Rome, Greece, Anatolia, the Hittite kingdom, the Mitanni state, Urartu, etc., Iran and India, Western Europe, the Balkans, Afghanistan, and others were created under the direct cultural and linguistic dominance of the Indo-European peoples of Turan as they expanded beyond the Great Steppe. The role of this Turanian factor in the origins of historically known states is veritable with numerous historical examples, in which nomadic peoples subjugated settled populations and only jointly thereafter established political structures resembling or being states in the full sense of the word. The nomadic peoples assembled city fortresses as centers for the storage and the protection of tribute exacted from the conquered farmers. They also became the core of the military aristocracy of socially differentiated societies. In this sense, the Turanian factor is a state-forming factor. On this note, it is telling that neither nomads nor farmers create states on their own, and any forms of intertribal associations among themselves are short-term and unstable. This principle was first conceptualized by the Arab scholar Ibn Khaldun, 1332-1406, and in the 19th century this theory was developed in detail by the Polish-Austrian philosopher and sociologist Ludwig Gumpelowicz, 1838-1909. The civilization of Turan is founded on the basic envisioning of open space and, in accordance with Frobenius, Turanian civilization cultivates the symbolism of the number three. Moreover, in many of the myths and languages of the peoples of Turan, we theoretically ceaselessly encounter a male gender for the moon and a female gender for the sun. The telluric character of the logos of Turan is expressed in its foremost and rigidly, emphatically vertical orientation. The horizon of Turan structures the world along a vertical axis. This is expressed in the religion, cosmology, socio-political hierarchy, and psychological mode of Turanian societies. In the terminology of the sociology of the imagination as developed by the French sociologist Gilbert Durand, 1921-2012, this type of society corresponds to the psychic regime of the Dun. This regime is typified by a high degree of strict divisions, an attraction towards light and crystal clarity, an aspiration towards cleansing itself from materiality and corporeality, the sacralization of the sky, luminaries, and elements of flight, high speed, rapidity, militancy and heroism, challenging death, masculinity, virility, cutting and piercing weapons, dualism, pairs of opposites, hierarchies founded on subjugation and force. All of these considerations allow us to suggest from the very onset that, in the horizon of Turan, we are dealing with the predominance of the logos of Apollo. This follows from everything that we know about the roots of European civilization and from theories on the Indo-European languages and cultures. We are tasked with determining to what extent this equivalence is convincing, justified, and legitimate, whether or not there are exceptions among the Indo-European cultures and, if there are, what has conditioned them?